call this meeting of the House Housing Committee to order. A quorum is present. Next, we have approval of the minutes.
Representative Bajie, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, I have, Mr. Chair, and so moved.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right, approved. Members, this week we're going to kind of begin the work of some overviews to help us as a committee get some kind of base level of understanding about the sort of state of play, if you will, in the housing space, what Minnesotans are facing, and what we as a state are currently doing about it, and help us build kind of the knowledge to think about what we should be doing about it. And so today we'll have an overview presentation from Minnesota Housing Partnership and hear from Minnesota Housing. And then tomorrow we'll hear from an array of folks across the housing continuum. And so without further ado, up first we have a presentation of Ann Mavity with Minnesota Housing Partnership. Hello. Ms. Mavity.
Is this microphone on? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I wasn't sure if the microphone is on. We are working on getting the we have a PowerPoint presentation that's in your packages, and there it is coming up. My name is Ann Mabby. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Housing Partnership. Chair Howard, Vice Chair Agbaje, and committee members, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk with you today about some of the housing challenges and some of the housing opportunities that we're facing here in Minnesota. can I do it here? The Minnesota Housing Partnership is a statewide organization that works in three areas to advance housing policy and housing investments for some of our hardest working, lowest income members of our community throughout Minnesota. We work in rural communities and with Native communities, providing direct technical assistance to help communities identify their own housing challenges and create solutions to address them. We also work in creating research on housing. We do a state of the state of housing report every 2 years. Our new 2023 one should come out shortly, and we'll make sure you have a copy of that as it does. And we also do district and county profiles on housing. So if you want to understand the housing challenges in your own communities, you can go to our website, and we have information to put in your hands and hands of your constituents as well to understand those housing challenges. And then we use all that research and that knowledge to drive housing investments and policies through advocacy, working with the state legislature. And you'll be hearing a lot more throughout this session from my colleague, Libby Murphy, right back here, who is our director of policy and lead lobbyist on these issues. So what we know about housing is this. Housing impacts every part of our lives, right? So we know that housing is fundamental to our state success and to every individual's success. It is where we do education. It's where we keep our health and maintain our health. It's where we start the day to get out for a job. We know that housing is central to the success of every household and family in Minnesota, and it's foundational to the success of our community and our economy as well. So, I wanted to talk today about a couple things. Actually, let me just, what I'm hoping today to accomplish are a couple things. One is for you to understand the lay of the land of what's happening in housing right now in Minnesota. The second thing is to understand this as a housing system. A lot of the times for folks that are struggling with housing, we think of it as individual failures. What I'm going to present today is explaining why these are systems challenges that need systems solutions. And then, again, make sure that you're understanding some of the various components of housing, because housing is complicated. There's every level of government it is engaged in housing and needs to be part of the solution, as well as across the housing continuum itself, from home ownership to rental, land trusts, all the way to homelessness. So it's a complicated system, and hopefully we'll clarify some of that for you today. So some of the terms that you're going to be hearing about throughout this session in this committee and among housing advocates, I want to ground us on what we're talking about. So what do we mean when we say affordable and affordable housing? The first thing is The typical benchmark is if you pay 30% of your income for housing, then you have enough money to afford the other things in life, food, health, transportation, all those other things. Of course, that's not entirely true when it comes to the lowest income folks, because you divide $21,000 a year salary by a third and suddenly you're getting squeezed on that end as well. But typically, the government standard and the standard throughout the housing world is people should pay no more than 30% of their income on housing. The other term that you'll hear that housing is sort of the benchmark to all the time is median income. Basic statistics, the median means half is more, half is less. We tie a lot of our housing programs to median income. So, and the median income, we have one for the state, but really it changes by geography. So each of your communities may have sort of its own geographic market issues, and you'll have your own community median incomes. And so when we talk about housing, 60% of area median income is typically what the federal government thinks about as affordable housing. 60%. In home ownership, it can be 60 to 80% of that median income. But what I also want to focus you on is our extremely low-income households. This is where the market really is not responding, and we're going to dig into that a bit. But that's when folks are at 30% of the area median income. And I think of those as the people that are taking care of my mom right now. They might be taking care of your kids. They might have served you coffee this morning. That's hardworking folks that whose salary and income just does not make enough money to actually afford the housing that's out there. And so what happens is that when people are paying too much for their housing, we talk about that as cost burdened. So if you're paying more than 30% of your income for housing, we say you're cost burdened. And it means that you're making sacrifices on other essentials in your life, whether that's food, healthcare, transportation, or other things. And if your severe cost burden means you're paying more than 50% of your income on housing. And it's important to understand that this is not an issue in just one community or another. This map shows you, the dark red is where the highest cost burdens are experienced. But as you can see, there's people paying too much for their housing in almost every corner of Minnesota. This impacts all of Minnesota. And again, when people are paying too much, other things in their lives and in our economy are suffering. And in fact, one in four Minnesotans is paying too much for their housing. And so we have 25% of our households that are feeling that cost burden right now. One of the things that you'll hear throughout as I talk today is that you can't talk about housing without talking about the racial disparities that we see in housing outcomes. So even in cost burdened, what we see is that while maybe half of white renters, for example, are cost burdened, that rises to almost 60% for black renters. And of course, those lowest income renters I was referencing earlier are paying even more, 80% of our low income households and families are actually paying way too much for their housing than what they can afford. Now, the other piece that we at MHP we have in the last couple of years factored into housing costs is the rising energy prices. We've done some research on this, and we can certainly follow up with any of you who are interested. But we know that energy costs are rising in Minnesota, and paying for those costs through utilities and other ways, again, are impacting all of Minnesota and or Minnesotans. And we know that while the average Minnesotan might be burdened by energy costs, 2%, we know that our lowest income households actually are at 13%. So energy costs matter when we're talking about keeping housing costs within reach. So in the last couple years during the pandemic, some of our research and numbers on folks that are unhoused has been a little bit off, right? The pandemic has shown both what is possible in terms of homelessness, but also has been a little fuzzy with the numbers, because part of what we did during the pandemic was made sure everyone had housing, right? Like people were going out there, we were getting vouchers for hotels, getting people out off of the encampments into housing and shelter that was more long-term during that pandemic. But what we do know is this. Nationally, in January, it'll happen another week or two, there's a one day that the whole nation counts their community who's homeless in their community. In Minnesota in January last year, almost 8,000 people were experiencing homelessness. And then the way we think about that is there's sort of a formula federally that's used to estimate how many folks are therefore homeless during the year in Minnesota, and it's well in excess of 20,000 folks in Minnesota that are unhoused, have housing instability, are experiencing homelessness. And of that, nearly half of them are youth and children below 24 years old. So it's really impacting our children in terms of that housing insecurity. And what I would say is that you may have heard this phrase, right? We need crisis responses for families that are experiencing those housing crises, right, where they are unhoused or something has happened in their lives where they have lost their housing. And we need shelter options to make sure that folks don't fall through the cracks. And in order to end those cycles, we need housing. So shelter saves lives, but housing is what's going to end homelessness. Housing is a heavier lift. It costs more. It takes longer, but it also has generational investments and impacts in our families and in our communities. So as we talk about homelessness, we talk about these numbers. Again, I want to bring this back to some of these racial disparities that we see. We know that if you are a household, a black, indigenous, people of color household, that you are half as likely to be a homeowner. We also know that similarly, such households are 2.5 times more likely to be cost burdened, and they're over six times more likely to experiencing homelessness. And what I would say is that all of this is not some random result. And it's not a failure of the individuals. What we have seen through generations, starting long before then, but including in one of the largest housing programs the United States has done, which is the GI Bill following World War II, through the FHA program, getting folks into home ownership where the suburbs exploded, where people of color were literally guided by the federal government not to be worthy of credit and not allowed those home ownership opportunities. So we are still trying to catch up to what happened way back when in terms of dealing with these racial disparities. And I would say we have to have that same level of intention and strategy in creating policies to turn that around as we're created when we set those policies in place. And I think there's a question. Oh, okay, sounds good. And so again, when we look at housing insecurity in general and what households are currently behind on rent, it's one of those leading indicators to look at some of the challenges that we're going to be facing. We know that black renters are feeling this in a much more dire way than white renters. So why are we in this mess, right? Like, what is it that brought us to this situation where we literally do not have enough housing for all families and the households in Minnesota that need it? This chart, which was produced by Minnesota Housing, really looks at this over time. Now, what you can see, the green line itself is tracking what we would predict between population growth, job growth, you know, where's the line of what we should be growing to in terms of population and job growth in terms of new units needed. But what happened was, during the Great Recession, 2006, 7, 8, and all, production plummeted. So it didn't come to a halt, but it plummeted. So we have tens of thousands of units every single year we would have expected to come online to keep up with that population growth and otherwise that did not. And we fell so far behind that we are now in sort of this catch-up zone, trying to oversupply for what we might need on an annual basis to keep up with population because we're so far behind in terms of the housing that's that should have been built if the market was in balance, right? But the market's not because our lowest income households are really not getting housing built through market tools. And this is one of what I would call one of my favorite charts, again, produced during the Governor's Housing Task Force back in 2018. On the right, the colorful sort of quadrants that you see are the number of rental units that we would want to see if we were actually responding to what the market needed. So those are by income. The lowest income is that green box down below. About 2,500 units a year would be built in order to keep up, right? And yeah, similarly, sort of by quadrants in these other income targets. On the left is what the market actually produced, right? Where it's overproducing units for those higher income households. And if you look super close, way at the bottom, you see a little line with 100 below it that's in green on that left bar. And that's how many housing units for people at 30% AMI and below, our extremely low income households, that's how many were created for the state in that year. And in recent years, that has increased, I think, to 377 units or something like that, something in the range, under 400 units recently. So that's great. It's triple, you know, the amount of housing we produce, but not near to what it's needed annually. And what's happening, what happens is that year over year over year, that has added up to a shortage of almost 100,000 units for our very lowest income households that we need that we have not produced. So when people are saying, I can't find housing, it's not because they're not trying hard enough. It's because literally that housing is not available and accessible to them to get. So again, it's just really important to understand that as a systems and market issue more than a individual failure for not looking hard enough to find the housing. And that's true also for home ownership, where we are far behind in our in creating enough home ownership opportunities. At a minimum, we need 17,000 new households that need access to home buyer education and down payment assistance. And I will say, and let me just make sure I get my numbers right. In fact, 27,000 households right now who are renting affordable units, right? They're eligible to be homeowners, but they haven't gotten into home ownership. So the more we can get folks into home ownership, they're actually living in the affordable units that will help loosen that market squeeze that we're feeling right now. And similarly, when we look at racial disparities in home ownership, we know we're some of the worst in the nation. At a minimum, we need 5,000 first-time homeowners getting access into home ownership, but in fact, we've only been producing 100 to 150 new affordable home ownership units in the states with our current investments. So we have a ways to go, and you'll hear a whole lot more about that from home ownership experts as we move through the session. So the other trend that's impacting this market issue, this supply and demand issue, is that, you know, in a 10-year period, while rents are increasing, this data is from 2021 State of the State of Housing Report, you know, rents increased by 14%, income is going down 1%. That trend is squeezing the affordability. It's squeezing what people are able to purchase in the marketplace and access in the marketplace. So that makes it hard. What we know is this. Housing is essential. Yeah, workforce housing is absolutely essential to support our economy. One of the things we look at are what are the top growing job categories that are coming. So DEED produces sort of what are those the fastest growing job categories. And what you see here is that for so many of these fastest growing job categories, they do not pay enough to afford an average two-bedroom apartment. So folks are working hard, fully employed, and this is where the market's guiding, and yet the housing costs have escalated so much that housing is still out of reach. Oh, my battery is running low. Well, that's okay. Yeah, there you go. So the other thing that just came out actually a couple weeks ago from the Harvard Joint Center on Housing Studies looks at this in terms of home ownership as well, in terms of the income needed to afford a median priced home and what a median household income is. This particular chart that's in your packets shows by different locations here in Minnesota, Rochester, Brainerd, St. Cloud, and what you see is that the income needed is higher than what the actual income is. So in order to afford home ownership in every single one of these communities, in terms of what it would cost to get in, yeah, the average income is actually less. So that differential, again, is part of what's squeezing this. And the other indicator we look at in when we're analyzing the market, why is the market so unbalanced between supply and demand? You see this with rental vacancies, right? That a healthy rental vacancy is anywhere between 3 and 7%. We'll sort of tag it at about 5%, which really gives enough income and competition for a property owner, but also the tenants themselves have enough choice. Right now, for our lowest income households, the vacancy is essentially zero. It is the tightest market, and it has stayed as the tightest market. And part of that challenge is that there's not enough rental assistance to assist folks to get into housing as well. So when they can't afford it, typically the federal government, through a housing choice voucher program, has provided assistance. In fact, for every four eligible renter households, they're eligible to receive rental assistance, there's only enough in the federal budget for one of them to get it. Now, if we did that for education and said, well, we ran out of money, only 25% of our students are going to get educated, you'd be like, that's crazy. But we do that for housing, right? And so, you know, I think we've made assumptions about what's status quo or something, and we need to really shift our thinking on how that makes sense. And in fact, all eligible homeowners who are eligible for the home mortgage interest deduction, there's no budget cap on that. Everyone who's eligible gets the home mortgage interest deduction, but not everyone who's eligible gets rental assistance. So other indicators, evictions are on the rise. You know, we saw that during the moratorium, of course, when we didn't have evictions. What we're seeing now is sort of this pent-up evictions. Folks are suffering. They can't afford housing, and we're seeing evictions rise, and that's going to be a leading indicator on some of the challenges that we're going to be facing. The last two things I just want to point out is, so we have affordable housing. We have affordable housing in our community. And actually, the vast amount of affordable housing is in the private sector. It's not by government or nonprofits. It's actually in the private sector. And we call it naturally occurring affordable housing, or NOAA. So if you hear NOAA being thrown around, that's what that's about. And it's all over Minnesota. And we have a lot of research at MHP on our website, and we've done it regionally as well. So we have different communities in greater Minnesota as well as the Twin Cities. One of the challenges that we're seeing with NOAA is that we're actually losing more affordability to inflation, to property sales, and to expirations. We're losing more affordable housing from the private sector than we are creating on the front end, right? Because a lot of this is affordable just because it's old. I call it hardworking housing for hardworking folks, right? It's older, and that makes it affordable. But we're losing it. Preserving affordability is key. And we also see that for our publicly financed housing as well. So when we finance housing, there's oftentimes terms of that. 15 years is usually a minimum, and it might go up further to 40, 50, 60 years, but 15 years that is the minimum. And what you can see in this chart is that in addition to needing to create new housing to keep up with population growth and job growth, we got to preserve what's already out there because we're going to be losing housing even as we're trying to create it on the front end. So both of those are challenges that we want to make sure that we stay on top of. And again, this is more of a trend line on home ownership. Just to really point out that not only has home ownership sort of remained flat for white Minnesotans, this trend line has actually gone down for black families and households, where there was a higher percentage of homeowners in 1950 than there is today in Minnesota. And that's certainly something that is absolutely unacceptable, but I think we can do better. I think we can all agree we can do better. So in closing, oh, and I just want to say, you have the housing continuum at your fingertips there. We created that to be a little bit of a resource for you in understanding sort of all these different terms that we use, what some of those solutions are sort of tagged to depending on income and challenges folks are facing. So in general, I just want to say Minnesota Housing Partnership is a resource to all of you as throughout the session for facts and figures to explain some of these issues if we can be helpful. This is just one of those many tools. So I will end with this and then happy to answer any questions, which is generally, we need to raise expectations on what, at the level and scale at what we, how we really invest in housing. I think this idea of, we've thrown out before, y'all know what percent of the state's budget is spent on housing right now? You do, you can't answer. It's less than 1%, a percent of 1%. We think we can do much better, and we think we need to in order to really sustain and float our economy in a way that allows everyone to thrive in their lives. So one thing is just changing our expectations about what that right moment, what that right scale is to invest in housing, because it has generational positive outcomes and impacts. In the past, we know incremental investments have produced incremental improvements. Those are good, they're not enough. And I know that, look forward to talking with all of you on how we can do better and solve for some of these challenges.
Thank you, Ms. Mavity. We do have a few questions. First, I'll go to Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Mavity, good to see you. You've presented before the commission that I co-chair with Senator Dziedzic. Representative Fisher is on that, as is Senator Housley. This is a very good overview, and I am grateful that you call this a systemic problem, because it's a system. I use the example of a quadratic equation, and you've heard it, and many of my colleagues have suffered through it. But it really is that there are multiple integers, both above and below the line, that have to be solved. The rental market is one of them, and I think as is starter homes, because you, in your bar graph, said that that number is exceptionally small. I guess my question for you on all of these lacks of housing starts are, what are some of the policy impediments that you have seen to get us to this point in either my quadratic equation or your system analysis that has gotten us here?
Ms. Mavity.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Nash. I would say that it's probably a longer answer, and we're happy to sit down with you in terms of the policy impediments. I will say that one of the challenges has been the racial disparities and the fact that we haven't fully corrected from inequitable policies that were set in motion, because removing them isn't enough. We have to actually intentionally think about what comes next and how do we actually do better. So I think that that imbalance in opportunity and investments and the disinvestment in our communities of color has been one key issue and blind spot I think we've had for decades. I think another thing is, as we look at sort of the example of rental assistance, that everyone who's eligible for a mortgage interest deduction gets it, including a lot of higher income households, but not everyone who's eligible for a rental assistance, which would be our lowest income household, get it. And I think as we think about who's benefiting from the kinds of investments that we do, I think that we, again, we need to be a little more intentional about making sure that that we give adequate power and influence and credibility to the voices that are really looking at that are most impacted by the results of some of our policies. Maybe that's more of the inputs than the outputs.
Representative Nash.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree. And for those members that have not read the article that came out all this COVID years jammed together, but I think it was 2022 from the Star Tribune. I can get my staff to track it down and we'll share it with all of you. It is really very illustrative of what's happened. Policies made by cities years ago have now been considered modern redlining. And I think that that's a huge eye opener from the conversation that we need to have around the racial component of that. And I think that that would be good reading for all of us. I think in some of the other studies that we've been seeing, and I don't know if you agree with this, Ms. Navity, is that many of the municipal policies that get created relative to the building of new homes have sort of disincented the builders from getting to the point where they can build those homes. Because if you have many of the things that have been layered on making our cities pretty, it makes it so that it's financially disadvantageous. Is that correct from your assessment?
Ms. Mabdi.
Chair, Representative Nash, absolutely. And I would say that generally speaking, we do think that the tools that cities have in terms of zoning, upzoning as it were, making it easier as of right to do the kinds of developments that are needed. It's part of our legislative agenda, and we would hope part of yours as well. In examples that we see, this is not just a local issue. Even in the city of Los Angeles that put a lot of money down to build affordable housing has run into roadblocks because of actually siting it and getting the approvals. So we think it's a both and to make sure that we have the resources to do it and that we clear the way that cities will do it. And I think part of that is a perception, right? Folks, it's like, who needs affordable housing? I need a housing that's affordable to me. I know that my children, my young adult children, they need housing that's within reach of them. And the more that we see this as a we're all in, as opposed to an us and them issue, which I think often happens in those localized conversations, I think the faster we'll get to solutions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couldn't agree more, and would invite you to come to the office so we can talk through some strategies, both for this committee and then the subcommittee that I will continue chairing. I'll say to my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, many of you know me to be partisan on a handful of things. Representative Hassan's grinning at me. This is not one of them, and the chair knows that as well. This is something we all have to solve, and I would encourage you, I would love to sit down and chat and gain from your knowledge and you from mine. My kids are in their mid-20s. They can't afford to buy a house if they wanted to come back to Minnesota, but they could buy one in Texas. They can buy one in South Dakota. They could buy one in a lot of other places, and in many ways that's because of zoning decisions and municipal decisions. But as it relates to the apartment component of this, you have my commitment to work with you on that, because again, the Star Tribune article was completely eye-opening. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a question in regards to what appears to me to be a discrepancy in some of the information that's coming here, and it may have to do with just the discussions you just had. But in regards to this continuum, I looked at the first two income levels, and it looks like we have 35% of BIPOC households in those two categories, and 38% in white households in those two categories. Yet I think you indicated that you were twice as likely in BIPOC communities to be rent challenged versus white. And so it doesn't seem to be indicating that it has to do with income, but with something else. And so I'm curious as to why that is.
Ms. Mavity.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Peterson. We will make sure you can read this more clearly. The 19% of households that are BIPOC is 90% of total households. So as we talk about sort of in Minnesota and sort of the basic demographics in Minnesota, it's not 19% of that category. So I apologize if that's not clear, and I'm happy to sort of talk you through this and make sure that this chart is clear for you.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, no, I understood that.
Oh, okay.
So you got 19% of BIPOC communities are in that household, or in that category. 16% are in the next category above that. That's a total of 35% of the entire group of BIPOC households that are in that category, correct, in those two categories?
I tell you what, I am going to make sure, we will get back to you and make sure that this is communicated clearly. So as you're talking about this, I want to make sure that I have the right information, so I'm not going to talk off the cuff, if that's, excuse me.
Thanks, Ms. Bowdy. Is that satisfactory, Representative Petersburg, or a follow-up comment?
Yeah, I think so, because if we're doing apples to apples, the same would be true of the white households as well, and it's 10% and 28% on those two categories as well. And so it would indicate as a percentage of the households that they are much higher percentage of households in the white category in those two levels, and yet we're saying that distressed ones are higher in the BIPOC, and I'm just curious as to why that is. That was my question.
Thanks, Representative Petersburg, and I'll allow to follow up offline if that makes sense, Ms. Mavity.
Yeah, absolutely. What I will say is, as a high-level takeaway, and we'll make sure that this is clear, as a high-level takeaway is the vast majority of folks that are at the lowest income level are disproportionately households of color. And so there are racial disparities in who is impacted. But I will make sure that that's representative more clearly for you.
Representative Igbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Mavity, for being here. I just, you know, wanted to say thank you for this presentation. It just definitely shows that there's a clear showing of the crisis and the variety of tools that we may have at our disposal to try to address it. One of the tools that you talked, or one of the measurements that you talked about, which kind of gets to my question, is if we're necessarily using the right standards when we're thinking about how to fully capture people who are cost burdened and who may not have access to affordability. So one of those is AMI. I know you said the federal government uses 60% of AMI. For my county, Hennepin County, they also use a higher AMI standard, which makes it hard for people to find places that are affordable. And if you can just talk a little bit more about if there's other ways to kind of think about AMI or other tools to kind of measure that affordability to be able to make sure that we're figuring out ways of either to build or preserve to get more access to affordability to more people.
Ms. Mavity.
If I'm understanding your question, Vice Chair Akaje. If I'm understanding the question, what I would say is that there are a variety of pressures on a household budget that are informing what kind of housing and what level of affordability is within their reach. What we see in greater Minnesota, for example, is that transportation costs can be extraordinarily high because people are driving to childcare and back and to a job and to their home, and that can be an hour of driving, which might be different than someone of the same AMI level in the cities. So that there are different factors that are informing affordability. And so I think that that's important as a context. In general, and you'll hear from the Housing Commissioner in a minute, clearly we need clear guidelines on how we allocate resources and how we target resources. We do know that, of course, the lowest income households are the ones where the market is not responding. And that's where the housing is the most in short supply. And again, it's just not responding, and that needs more state strategy, investment, and assistance. So we can explore what benchmarks and measurements might better accomplish that. And I think it can be different depending on the community's particular issues and challenges.
Vice Chair Igbaje?
Nothing further, Mr. Chair.
I have two members on the list, and I think we'll cut it off after that, and then we'll go to the commissioner. And I know that Ms. Mavity will be available for folks too. So next, we have Representative Hassan and then Lee Johnson.
Mr. Chair, my comment can wait after the presentation after the commissioner. That's fine.
Okay, Representative Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard. Mavity, mm-hmm. I'm sorry about that.
Okay.
We all have a goal that we want everybody to be able to afford a home. A rental unit is not a home. It's a place to live from housing providers. We have areas that have inflated their home values because of policies put on, such as in Minneapolis, where their plan is and their goal now is no more new single-family homes. That started in 2019, and we've seen just an exorbitant cost for a home for sale in Minneapolis just skyrocket. which has also increased the value of the rental units, making it so it's very hard to get the affordable housing in Minneapolis, even in the rental unit, in the rental market. And as we go into a recession, which is a good possibility, we will be rental costs skyrocket, even more than housing costs. We also had an issue in 2008 with the housing bubble and the burst. I got the unfortunate job of going around and giving foreclosure notices to all the people as a deputy sheriff. And the number of vacant lots and just basement slabs that I foreclosed upon outweighed the number of homes that were actually built. But right after that, what happened, it was the value of a home, a pre-existing home, or a new home that was built, the cost to build that home was more than the value of the home itself. Mm-hmm. We finally got that turned around, and we're now at a point where, because of getting materials to build a home, builders can't build. They don't have the materials in stock because the just the chaos trying to get the materials. So we got a lot of work to do on that end. But I have a feeling, and when I look at things and look at this information, I appreciate the information very much. But we got to figure out a way to stop some of the regulations and the zoning ordinances and the policies put on by cities that have exacerbated the cost of home and housing. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing I want to work on. We need single-family starter homes, which are not being built. We, in the last few years, we've done a lot of building in the rental units. We had that 7,000 number of at the higher end, and most of them, when I was looking at things, were senior living centers. So we went there. In my community, we're in desperate need of rental units for workforce housing, not just low income or subsidized. We need workforce housing because we have the jobs, but we don't have the people. And we also have the issue, like in Minneapolis, a lot of people don't want to leave their communities. They want to be where they grew up. But with policies that don't allow building of the single-family homes, that makes it even more difficult. So the number of units available are limited, and supply and demand, when there's no supply and high demand, the costs go up. So we got that's something that we got to figure out how we're going to do as this committee and how we're going to work on it in order to get people that new family home, that they starter home, so they can work their way up.
Ms. Mavity, do you have a response or a closing comment?
Yes. One of the beauties of the challenges and beauties of housing is that it's extraordinarily complex in terms of how it's created, but also that every community, and frankly every family, has a different vision of what home is. And I know, like my parents who just sold their home and they live in an apartment downtown, it's their home. So rental housing is a home choice for many folks for lots of different reasons. And I think that as we think about how do we support the creativity and the demand and needs of those individual families in what they want and what suits their family. Rental might be a land trust home, a cooperative, it could be a single family home. That's important. And so I think that, again, Minnesota is quite diverse and varied from edge to edge. And we have those kinds of solutions and smart folks in the community that are helping solve for those in a good way. We can follow up with more detail later. Specifically, land costs are one of the drivers for housing costs. And so the more some communities that have more densities and are more populated, helping leverage those land costs among many units instead of a single one can help reduce the cost of housing. And that's one of the ways in which we reduce the cost of housing. And sometimes that's a really good choice for some communities and sometimes not for others. So there's lots of reasons that I think are going into these cost escalations, which also means we need a variety of solutions, which you're going to be hearing about throughout the session.
Thanks, Ms. Mavity.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate your time. And next we have the Commissioner of Housing to come up to give us an overview of Minnesota housing. Commissioner Ho, welcome to the committee.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Ho. I'm the commissioner at Minnesota Housing. I just got appointed for my second term. I've been doing this job for 4 years and look forward to four more years. I don't know that a lot of people say this. It's great to be back in the state office building and great to be back with this committee. I'm here today with Dan Kitzberger as my legislative director. You'll be seeing a lot of Dan this session. You'll see me when you ask to see me, but you'll be seeing a lot of Dan. And new to our policy team is Amanda Wellover, who will also be up here at the Capitol. It's a pleasure to be here. Chair Howard, if I have my notes right, a brief introduction of myself and then a walkthrough of agency programs, or should I just skip me and go straight to agency programs?
Commissioner, we'd love you to introduce yourself to the committee, give us a little overview, and then we'll get to the overview.
Thank you, Chair Howard. I am a short version. I grew up in Fridley. Before we used the term starter house, it was the first house my parents bought together. 2 weeks before I was born, they still live there. It is the same house that they will hopefully successfully age out of. Fingers crossed, they're in their mid-80s. It's kind of a day-to-day piece these days with aging parents. When I got out of college, I ended up spending 10 years in managed care, working predominantly on Medicaid and Medicare managed care at Blue Cross Blue Shield and United Health Group. While I was at Blue Cross Blue Shield, I was invited to a meeting about people who wanted to build housing for people who were experiencing homelessness and about the proposition that homelessness was actually expensive to the healthcare system, and if we could successfully house people, it would actually be a more efficient use of public resources. I was intrigued enough to leave my job at United Healthcare and join a startup nonprofit that was working on this issue. I had the opportunity to work with the legislature for 10 years from 2000 to 2009, largely in the Health and Human Services Committee, creating funding in order to do housing and services, permanent supportive housing, for people with long histories of homelessness. We were interested in documenting the cost of homelessness and the cost impact of people being stably housed, and in fact found out that it was more cost effective to get people into stable housing and support them there than it was to have them working their way through shelter and emergency rooms, long hospitalizations, jail, and other expensive institutional settings. In doing that work, I got involved in national and federal conversations about this, which led to an opportunity to work in Washington, D.C. for 7 years, where I worked both on creating the first ever federal plan to prevent and end homelessness and across federal agencies on homelessness policy, then had the opportunity to work in the HUD Secretary's office for 4 years for two secretaries working on homelessness, aging, disability policy, and kids. That was my first time in government service. When I had the opportunity to put my name in to be the housing commissioner, I thought it was a great opportunity to translate what it was that I had learned from a nonprofit perspective, what I had learned from my time in the federal government, and apply it to state government. It has been a heck of a last 4 years, but I have learned so much about what the agency does and the important role that state government plays in a largely private sector housing market, as well as the importance of the federal government. And I just feel really lucky to have the opportunity to continue to do this job. So that's me. And let me jump into an overview of the agency. And Chair Howard, up to you. I'm happy to take questions as they come or to get through these slides and take them all at the end.
Commissioner, I think we can let's try to get to the end, but if someone has a burning question, I'll sense it and what we can stop.
Okay, thank you, Chair. So why is Minnesota Housing here? It's for exactly the same reasons that Ms. Mavity talked about. We know that housing impacts Minnesotans of all backgrounds in all corners of the state, and that housing touches all areas of our life. Certainly for me, I learned that through the lens of healthcare, but certainly education, jobs, and many other things. The Minnesota Housing Finance Agency is a bit of a unique state agency. We weren't established until 1971 as a result of some changes that happened in the federal government. So we were established in 1971 by the legislature. I have a 7-member board of directors, which includes the state auditor, and 6 members who are appointed by the governor. We have a lot of independent points of review. We do an annual independent financial audit with an outside auditing firm, and we're also looked at frequently by the ratings agencies. We are a bond issuing agency, and so Standard & Poor's and Moody's keeps an eye on the agency. We're unique in that we run the state's housing bank. So we make, we use bond financing and other things to make loans in order to support the rental housing market and home ownership. And as we get paid back on loans, we're able to use some of the money that we earn on our lending in order to pay for our own operating costs. So we are 100% self-financed because the work of the agency generates money for us to pay for ourselves. So I don't need to come here and talk to you about our pressing IT projects or the need for more staff if we get more resources. Talked a little bit about our size relative to the state budget. The work that you do at state appropriations represent about 4% of my overall agency budget, but I would say a very, very important 4% of my budget. I mentioned Moody's and Standard & Poor's. You know, think of us really as a mission-driven financial institution, but we are a large financial institution. Pleased to have great ratings from both Moody's and Standard & Poor's. We're one of the top state housing finance agencies in the country around our lending for home ownership, one of the highest producing HFAs in the country around home ownership. The way that our whole economic model is done, that what we do actually generates more revenue to be able to plow back into what we do. I think that I have the honor of leading what's considered by many to be the strongest housing finance agency in the country. I don't just say that, my raters say that. The national financial advisors that work across housing finance agencies say that. And I don't take credit for it because it was the strongest housing finance agency in the country when I took over 4 years ago. But I also think our partnership with the legislature is one of the things that makes us special across housing finance agencies. Not every state legislature or assembly gives appropriated dollars to their housing finance agencies. Some of them just kind of work on the side with their bonding authority and allocation of housing tax credits. It's the partnership that we have with the legislature and have had since our inception that allows us to go further on work like preventing and ending homelessness, that allows us to do rental housing that is for folks who make the least, that allows us to do home ownership counseling and other things that we do in a whole range of housing activities. As I said, we're basically a financial institution. So everything that we do in partnership with community. Housing is kind of the public-private partnership. We do that with lenders who are actually working with households to buy a home and get a mortgage. We do that with the development community that actually orchestrates both new development, new construction, as well as preservation. We do it with a range of service providers across the state, whether they're working with people on the verge of homelessness or whether they're a service provider in a supportive housing setting. So it's through these partnerships that we're able to help Minnesotans across the state. So simplest way to think about what Minnesota Housing does is if you think about home ownership and rental, on the home ownership side, we finance mortgages and down payment and closing cost assistance. We finance home improvement and rehabilitation loans. We do grants for organizations to do homeowner counseling, education, and training. We have some intensive ways of preparing people for home ownership where people build credit or do credit repair, as well as savings in preparation for not just buying a house, but maintaining a house and understanding not only what it takes to buy a house, but what it takes to keep one up once you get it. We also are involved in financing the development of new single-family homes that are affordable to folks who have the income to be able to do the mortgage but can't compete in the market with a high price of housing. On the rental side, we also finance both the creation and preservation of rental housing that's affordable. That's through both, we also do rental assistance and operating subsidies for rental properties. We work in the area of homelessness prevention and assistance. We are also a large administrator of HUD project-based Section 8 contracts. These are private owners across the state that have a contract with HUD to be able to do keep rents low for residents, and we are the administrator of how those providers use HUD's money and are in the middle of that process. If you look in any community around the state, you can probably find the federally assisted apartment building in that community, and it's our job oftentimes to make those things work the way they're supposed to work in partnership with the folks that are the property managers there. The last 3 years, we have also had the opportunity to administer the federal emergency COVID-19 housing assistance, both for past due housing payments as well as for homeowners who got behind on their mortgages. We are currently open for homeowners who are behind, so I will use this as my public service announcement. If you know homeowners who have gotten behind on their mortgages or other homeowner-related expenses, they can go to homehelpmn.org. We still have federal assistance that's available. But we also play a role in the broader policy space. It's our job to understand what's happening in the housing market, on the single family side, on the rental side, on what's happening in homelessness, and also because we work closely with my peers around the country, we also really try to understand what's happening nationally and how what's happening in Minnesota compares to what's happening in other places. So what we don't do is we don't build it, we don't develop it, we don't own it. We are not a regulator. We are a finance agency, not a regulator. We don't set or control local housing, zoning, or land use policies. We don't administer the tenant-based Section 8 housing choice vouchers. That's done by public housing authorities across the state. We don't directly help people find housing. We don't mediate in landlord-tenant disputes. We are basically the state's housing bank. Minnesota Housing Partnership did a great job of just giving an overview of housing needs across the state. So what I wanted to do is kind of focus on how Minnesota Housing has impact in those important areas. If you take a look at the agency's expenditures in federal fiscal year 2021, and I apologize in advance, we work in both the calendar year, the state fiscal year, and the federal fiscal year, and sometimes we're actually working in future years. It's a lot, but I'll try to note that it's the federal fiscal year when that's what we're talking about. But we put out $1.92 billion in expenditures in 21, helping over 93,000 households. If you take a look at the areas where that make up that $1.2 billion, the vast majority is home buyer and home refinance. So in the area of single family home ownership, $1.2 billion. Next largest item is rental production, and parenthetically you can see the number of households served in each of these areas. Rental assistance contract administration, I mentioned the HUD contract for project-based Section 8, that's almost 30,000 units across the state and over 200 $1 million. The emergency recovery programs, those are temporary one time, but we'll still see them in our financials probably into 24, maybe even 25. $150 million there. Home improvement, now you know, beginning to shrink down in terms of what we do. Housing stability and our work in the homelessness space, $28 million. Single family development, just under $10 million. Home buyer education, $2.5 million. And other is just kind of a catch of other small things like disaster recovery, the manufactured housing relocation trust fund, and things like that. Another way to take a look at this is that the agency does a two-year affordable housing plan where we project where we think that we'll be spending money given our where we came out with the legislature, where things are at with federal programs and things like that. So if you take a look at the uses, that's not dissimilar to the previous slide, but the sources are largely the work that we do in the bond market, issuing bonds for both single family mortgages as well as rental housing mortgages. The appropriated resources, once again, that's 4% of the agency's budget. Federal resources, 26%. And then I talked about how when we earn money, we push it back out. That's the Housing Affordability Fund as well. We know the legislature is always interested, and we as a state agency need to be interested in where our dollars go. So when we took a look at all the investments that we made between 2018 and 2021, the competitive resources, those where we do a request for proposals, have people send us proposals, we score them and make decisions. About 53% of those resources went in the metro area and 47% in greater Minnesota. That can change a little bit from year to year, but that's something that we pay very close attention to. So now let me shift gears and talk specifically about our partnership with the legislature and our appropriated program. Excuse me, Chair Howard. Chair Port had me talking a lot just before I came over here, so glad I got my water. First of all, you'll hear me talk a lot about the housing continuum, and especially in a unique session like this with the surplus opportunities, the need to fund the full housing continuum. So when I talk about the housing continuum, I'm talking about everything from homelessness prevention to homeownership. So homelessness prevention, ameliorating homelessness, supportive housing, the rental housing market, and home ownership. So that, to me, is the housing continuum. Favorite graph, I think it makes the same point that Ann made. If you take a look at the state budget, that little green sliver is the part that goes to Minnesota housing. I would welcome the opportunity to grow that piece of the pie with you all this session.
Just quickly, Commissioner, I've been using 0.3%, so I need to update my talking points, but I think it probably is that 0.1% might be those housing infrastructure bonds that are included here.
That may well be the difference.
Commissioner, I hope we can bump that number up too.
If you take a look at our 2024-2025 base budget, we have 15 different line items in our state appropriations that we think of in these five buckets. Here. The largest are around the area of housing stability and homelessness prevention, where we have the Housing Trust Fund and the Bridges Program that are providing rental assistance, and then the family homelessness prevention stuff. So about 50% of our appropriations are housing stability resources. Those obviously go to lowest income families and individuals, people who are either experiencing or at risk of homelessness. And the average income of the households that are served by these programs is $10,000 a year. The average income is $10,000 a year of the people served by these programs. Another 20% of appropriated programs are development programs, again, targeted at households with the lowest incomes, primarily households earning less than $25,000 a year. Our largest appropriated program is the Economic Development and Housing Challenge Program. We affectionately call that Challenge. And one of the reasons that we love it is that it has a lot of flexibility around both, it can be used for single family or it can be used for multifamily rental. It can be used for new production or it can be used for preservation. And what communities do is they tell us what they want to do with it. So it's really a great way to make sure that instead of having a funding stream that only does one thing, and if you need that one thing, you can come to it with Challenge, you can help meet the housing needs of your community, whether you're in the largest city or the smallest township across the state of Minnesota. We also have a program that's exclusively focused on just Greater Minnesota, the Greater Minnesota Workforce Development Program. And then a few of the programs support and strengthen home ownership. I'd highlight today the homeownership education, counseling, and training, which is how we get people ready to take the big leap into home ownership. I remember the day I closed on my home, scariest stack of paper I ever signed. It's quite a commitment to make that piece. It's also a network of organizations that can also help with counseling if people are at risk of losing their homes. I think what's really emerged recently is something that you were just talking with Minnesota Housing Partnership about, was the need to preserve existing lower cost affordable housing that doesn't have any government subsidy in it whatsoever. That which is called naturally occurring affordable housing, a term I still find to be kind of bizarre, but anyways, it's not federally assisted, it's not state assisted, it's not regulated, it's not subsidized. And that's an area that we see is a very cost-effective way to make sure we have a good supply of units that are available to people who make the least, because it costs a lot less to preserve a unit than it does to build one from scratch. What I'd like to do is shift now and just do kind of a quick walkthrough of the line items. One of the main reasons we like to get this into the committee's hands early in session is that this can be a cheat sheet for you, especially for members who are new to the committee, as we're talking about various line items across our budget. So starting with homelessness prevention, the Family Homelessness Prevention and Assistance Program. Best way to reduce homelessness is to stop it before it happens. The second best thing to do is to make sure that when people become homeless, they can resolve that homelessness as quickly as possible. And the Family Homeless Prevention Assistance Program lets us do both. These are grants to counties, CAP agencies, nonprofits, other local organizations, tribal collaborative, all there to provide direct assistance to help pay for somebody to get back into housing or to pay arrears. You can see in the box, and there'll be this for every page, about the size of the annual spend, the number of households served, almost 4,800 in 21, the median income, and the percentage of households of color that, based on the data we've collected from the providers that they collected from households. So 59% of families helped by the FHPAP, Family Homeless Prevention Program, for households of color. The Housing Trust Fund is a rental assistance program operated by the agency that either is rental assistance that a family has to use in the market, or it's tied to a service provider or a unit and keeps a unit affordable. We have grants to 39 local organizations, and what that does is ensures that people pay only 30% of their income on rent. There's two ways that we get to affordability. We either try to establish rents in buildings that are affordable based on area median income, a percentage of area median income, or we pin it to the actual individual household, so what you pay for rent is based on what you and your household have in income. So the Housing Trust Fund, almost $12 million, 2,200 households. Again, extremely low-income households, high proportion of households of color. The Bridges program was created targeting families or single adults where an adult member had a serious mental illness. This program was created because sometimes the wait for a public housing choice voucher can be long, so it tended to be a bridge to that, a long bridge in some instances, but it really helps people with mental illness to have a stable home that they can afford. That's a little over $3.5 million. We help almost 700 households, median income of $10,005, 32% are households of color. And then the last one in the housing stability bucket is Homework Starts with Home. This was really a targeted homelessness prevention program, really understanding the number of kids that are identified by our schools who are in families who are experiencing housing instability, really designed to recognize that a kid can't do well in school if they don't have a stable home to go to, if their family's moving around a lot. It's just really hard to do the natural things we want to see kids do in their development. This brings together local units of government, school districts, nonprofits, different partnerships to help create collaborative approaches for identifying kids and stabilizing them in proximity to their schools. Shifting buckets, build more homes. Again, the challenge program is a great tool that we have for this, the number one source of state appropriations. I will not disguise the fact I love the challenge program because it allows the agency to be responsive to local community needs and what it is that local communities tell us they want us to do. We tend to do zero interest deferred loans, sometimes grants to for-profits, nonprofits, local units of government. As I mentioned, it lets people identify what their need is and gives us the tools to fund it, new construction, rehab, rental, and homeownership. I love challenge. Not that I don't love the other 14, but the nice thing about challenge is it has that flexibility that lets me be responsive to what communities say they need. Workforce and affordable homeownership, designed to increase the supply of homes, homes for sale that people can afford throughout the state. We work with cities, tribes, nonprofit organizations, cooperatives, land trusts. These dollars can be used for development costs, rehab, land development, manufactured home park infrastructure. The base funding is small. So if you take a look at what we were able to do in 2021, 11 units, we can do better. There's a lot more demand out there. There's a lot more need out there. The Greater Minnesota Workforce Housing Program. This has been a fun program for me to get to know. Had an opportunity this summer to make a stop in Roseau for a grand opening of one of these that was done by D.W. Jones in partnership with Polaris, where Polaris actually was an active partner in getting this deal done. And then we took a trip up to War Road, where we broke ground on a project in partnership with the City of War Road and Marvin Windows. So even in the furthest corners of the state, where you have a thriving manufacturing or agriculture business, that there's a reason to bring new people into the community. The biggest challenge for those employers is having a place for people to live. This has been a great tool to be able to do it. And it's really targeted at smaller communities in Greater Minnesota. You'll see in 2021, we did $1 million. There's room for more. Here. I guess I'll just pause to say, you know, we have 15 great programs that deliver what they're intended to deliver, and all of them are scalable. So as we think about things over the session, it's thinking about these 15 pipes as good pipes to pump more resources through is one of the ways that I'd invite you to think about our opportunity this year. Pivoting to supporting and strengthening home ownership. I've talked about down payment and closing cost assistance. We do a fair amount of this with agency resources. In the past, the legislature actually did more year to year. This is an area where we invite the legislature to help us. We know that down payment and closing cost assistance helps households who otherwise they don't have mom and dad to help them out with that chunk to get in, but they have the incomes in order to pay the mortgage once they get in the home. And I'm proud to say that for the agency. In our first mortgage production, we did 5,000 first-time homebuyer mortgages last year. 40% of our mortgages went to households of color. We also, as I mentioned before, the Homeownership Education, Counseling, and Training Program, really kind of just comprehensive support for becoming a homeowner, either grants to nonprofit organizations, pre-purchase, post-purchase counseling and support. This is a great partnership with the Minnesota Homeownership Center. And then in preservation, we have a rehabilitation loan program. These are 0% loans up to $37,500 to make improvements in owner-occupied homes. We do this through local units of government and nonprofit organizations, community action agencies that help us do this. And a lot of these loans are used to help help people age in place, to deal with health and safety issues related to an older home or around energy efficiency, in order to lower the operating costs of keeping a home. We have rental rehabilitation loans. These also are targeted in greater Minnesota, 0% deferred loans. That's great for the developers, nonprofits, units of government, or tribal housing corporations that can use it for moderate rehab of existing rental housing. And it's also designed for owners of smaller federally assisted properties, federally assisted HUD or USDA rural development housing in many small communities around town. This would probably be the largest rental building that's affordable in many communities. This is a way that we help make sure that we do that. And then we have another line item specifically around preserving federally assisted housing. We don't want to lose the rental assistance that's in buildings. So if we can help finance loans when these buildings that were built largely in the 60s and 70s, maybe early 80s, when they need a refresh, this is a way that we can help improve that local rental housing and keep it federally assisted so that federal money isn't lost to the state. An area that's been newer to the agency during my tenure is the work that we've done with manufactured home park communities on infrastructure. A lot of times, manufactured home communities were created outside of city water, city sewer. They have actually pretty desperate needs around clean water and effective sewer. They'll have roads that are in horrible condition, so the school bus won't drive in to pick up kids, the garbage trucks won't drive in to pick up trash. And so what we're finding is that we can make infrastructure investments to improve these communities. Sometimes that also helps take what had been vacant lots and make them ready to be able to add a new manufactured home, which also improves the community and the cash flow of the community overall. Now, this is a program that's been growing. Just in December, we did selections for this program, attaching $9.5 million to improve 742 home lots. So this is an area of growing capacity with the agency. And certainly manufactured home communities in many communities across the state are the most affordable housing communities. And historically, government hasn't really played a significant role in trying to figure out how to preserve them. We also have some capacity building resources. I'm getting close to the end. Where we assist organizations just to be able to deliver the kind of the critical activities that support the housing world, whether that's the entities that manage HUD's homeless assistance grants, Homeline, Open Access, and the Homeless Management Information System. These are ways that we can kind of just contribute to that vital capacity that communities need to make this happen. I'm sure you know how to find me, but I also want to make sure you know how to find Dan. Dan will be up here at almost every single hearing that you do. He and I look forward to being able to sit down with you individually, but I want you to know that the agency can be a resource to you on broader housing data, on ideas that you have, and whether they're operationalizable, whether the agency has the ability to operationalize them, And Celestia resourced you in housing generally, and happy to be available to you personally, but you're going to see a lot of them. So just want to make sure that you have this contact information as well. And with that, Mr. Chair, I complete my slides. We'd be happy to take any questions or comments that the committee has.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I won't belabor this. Commissioner, you and I have spoken a number of times regarding some of the IT problems and other problems with the rent help during the pandemic. Would you mind giving an update to the committee as to perhaps the number of payments that I think there are still a few have not been made or completed, or how long the backlog took to complete those? Because all of us have those housing providers in our district, and I think some of them experience a lot of problems in getting paid. And thankfully, we seem to be out of the woods, but obviously we want to prepare for the future if we were to ever experience that again and learn from our mistakes. Could you maybe help us out with that?
Commissioner.
Chair Howard and Representative Nash, yes, I do remember those conversations, and I'm pleased to say that when you take a look across the country, Minnesota has been recognized as running one of the more efficient programs. This was hard for all of us to stand up. It was one-time money, it was huge, and it was urgent. And it was retail business, we're in the wholesale bank business. So I will acknowledge that it wasn't an easy lift, but at the end of the day, we've been recognized as running one of the most efficient ones, and the proof of that is that the federal government on three occasions have reallocated money that wasn't being spent in other communities and given it to Minnesota. Now, they did that after we had closed our program. Folks remember that we opened the program in the 2021 session. I think it was April of 2021. And we closed the program in the end of January of 2022. The demand for the program was huge, and we were running out of resources. We paid out almost $450 million on behalf of about 60,000 Minnesotans. Even though it took a while to start paying, once we started paying, really, you know, worked through it. There were some tails on the program. It is closed. There will still be some cleanup, I think, for a while because it's just a complicated piece. There's no landlord registration centralized system. You know, we had to do tax statements and a bunch of other things. It was a fairly complex one-time lift. But I think that in retrospect, it was a heavy lift, it was big, but we did what it was intended to do. I hope there's never anything on the scale of what we were facing as we brought that up. I think that we have learned a lot. We do, because there were federal reallocations, have some funds remaining. We no longer have emergency authorizations to procure and set up, so we'll be going through a regular government procurement process. We just completed a survey of almost 1,000 Minnesota stakeholders because we have some options about how we spend the remaining funds. And interestingly, folks want us to deal with both the short-term crisis that many Minnesotans are still in, but also invest some of it in the long-term fixes. So that is something in real time. We don't have enough resources to stand a statewide portal up of the magnitude of rent help MN, so we're going to have to do something that's more targeted, and yet we're still going to have to do something that's compliant with the very individual level data requirements that the Treasury has on the program.
Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the Commissioner, and perhaps you or Dan or both of you could come to the office. I would like to sit down and talk through this because I do have some fairly strong connections to the housing provider community, and it didn't work well, and you acknowledge that. I appreciate that. But I do want to make sure that we're going through that conversation so that we can actually, when we're asked, go back to them and at least have the information at our fingertips to talk with them about that, because it was very, very, very cumbersome for them to get through. And I know a lot of them didn't get paid for a substantial length of time. And as a recovering business owner, I know that cash flow is always always a good thing. So if we could maybe set up a time to talk, that'd be great.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, be happy.
Representative Nash, I would say the lessons learned during that period, it's a really good conversation to have. And outside the IT piece, I would say one thing we learned is what happens when you provide an assistance to folks that are really struggling. And what happens when that goes away? You know, as we've saw from the slide during the Minnesota Housing Partnership, we've seen evictions skyrocket, and the need didn't go away, but the resource did. And so how do we wrestle with that, and what both our renters and our housing providers are facing? It's right in front of us. Representative Fasan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Mahvidi and Commissioner Howell, for this great presentation. For some of us, we're just nodding along and saying, there's nothing new here. We know about this. I represent a district that it has huge challenges when it comes to housing. Even in the brutal cold winter days, we have encampments and people sleeping outside. This is a crisis. It's a beyond crisis. And in a normal world, you know, a crisis requires an effective response and an proactive approach to make sure that we prevent that crisis. Of course, this needs money. Yes, we need to invest a lot of money in housing, but there's also like policy work that needs to be done. We need intentional, transformational, and systemic policies that prevent people from becoming homeless in the first place, because once you become homeless, it's actually easier to house somebody if they're in a crisis, to keep them there in their home housed than to house them after they become homeless. It's really not cost effective to have people sleeping outside. And of course, it's inhumane, but it also costs us a lot of money to house them in the future. There are racial disparities, economic disparities, and systemic disparities that are preventing folks from accessing stable and affordable housing. I hope all of us can, you know, challenge ourselves to think outside of the box and come up with creative ways to end this crisis, from shelters to transitional housing to stable and affordable housing and to home ownership. We must find solutions to end this crisis in each sector of this housing. Housing impacts our children's lives, which impacts our economy, which also impacts the outlook of Minnesota. And Rep. Nash, I would love to talk to you and have a conversation with you about how to remove these barriers, whether it's zoning, red tapes from local government, or systemic barriers that are keeping people from accessing affordable and stable housing. And finally, to my question is to the commissioner, is there a plan to increase the dollars that are spent on home ownership from the agency? Because some of us, when I look at what percentage of the agency's income that's going to home ownership, and knowing that Minnesota has some of the worst racial disparities when it comes to home ownership, it makes no sense to me. But maybe it makes sense from the agency's perspective, but is there a plan to increase that fund?
Commissioner.
Chair Howard, Representative Hassan, thank you for that. Let me talk about homelessness first and then pivot to home ownership. First of all, I have the honor of co-chairing Minnesota's Interagency Council on Homelessness that's led by the Lieutenant Governor. And it's staffed by a team that's housed at Minnesota, led by Kathy Tenbrook, who's the Executive Director of the Interagency Council on Homelessness and an Assistant Commissioner on my team. One of the things that I think we're doing that's really not government as usual is in the budget development process, we're talking across all of the cabinet agencies that are a part of the council about how different parts that come from different agencies fit together, because the solution isn't just going to come out of DHS. The solution isn't just going to come out of Minnesota Housing. It's not just going to come out of any one of us. It's really going to take all of us working together to do that. And so we're actually, last session and this session, the governor's budget presentation on housing stability will be an interagency budget presentation that includes all of the agencies that have a budget request as it relates to this. We're also talking to each other on policy. I know that Kathy Tenbrook would happily come. I'd happily come with her or just have her, however you want to do it. When we present the governor's budget towards the end of the month, to be able to show the way that we're thinking about it in this cross-cutting way. It is a much more logical way of trying to solve cross-cutting issues, as opposed to the historical way where agencies weren't allowed to talk to each other until the decisions had been made. So this is, I think, a real breakthrough in the way that we're doing state government right now. And yes, I I've talked mainly about appropriations today. I didn't talk about housing infrastructure bonds, but shelter saves lives, housing and homelessness. As Ann was saying, you know, I think the shelter programs largely rest over at the Department of Human Services, but we understand that Minnesota Housing's role in the housing and homelessness piece is significant, and housing infrastructure bonds are an incredible tool that we have to be able to finance supportive housing or housing for people who make the lowest amounts. It lets us buy down the rents compared to what we would do with a federal tax credit program. So having an opportunity to consider the power of housing infrastructure bonds to help us deal with this kind of lowest income piece of the housing continuum, but also as a solution in permanent supportive housing to homelessness. Pivot to home ownership. If you go back to the stacked or the bar chart that we have on our budget, on a $1.9 billion total outlay, more than $1.2 billion of that was around home ownership in terms of mortgage lending and helping people become homeowners. A small part of what we do is around production. It would certainly invite increases to programs like Challenge that would help us increase production of more homes, because it's not just down payment assistance, it's supply. We all know that. And it's getting harder and harder for communities to build a home at what had historically been considered an entry-level price. And so the agency does things to partner with providers through grants and other means to try to take a look at the difference between the appraised value of the cost of construction or the appraised value and what a home buyer can afford to come into the program. So state appropriations are an important tool in that. And we certainly would welcome the opportunity to do more. I hope that that answers your question, Representative.
Thanks, Commissioner. And I do want to note we're up against our time. One nice part about being here in person instead of Zoom, I guess this is nice depending on your point of view, we do have the ability to go a little bit longer. I know that Lee Johnson has a question, and so we'll go to Lee Johnson. Representative Hassan, do you have a follow-up? Then we'll go to Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Commissioner, I want to thank you for being here today. I know we're late on time, but caucuses start in 30 seconds ago. I just wanted to thank you for being here. One thing I'm concerned, want to make sure as we go through is dealing with, especially with the homeless and the eviction issues, making sure people stay in their homes, making sure that we are providing the wraparound services, how to do a budget when those people are in these programs, how to run a household, how to manage things. If we're just giving them the funding, we're not helping them. We're just keeping them down. We need to provide them the tools and stuff to give them the hand up to make them better citizens, better able to take care of themselves. So I'd like to be able to sit down in my office and talk to you about some of these things and find a way to actually help these people up to make them better people.
Thanks, Lee Johnson. Representative Perez Vega, did you have a...
Yes, I just want to thank the both of you for your presentations. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving me a second just to talk. I'm a renter, and my home is where I rent alongside majority of my constituents. And so just to address a member of the committee, Johnson, who stated that renters don't have homes, I'm not homeless, and neither are the renters in my district or in the state of Minnesota. And I want to point out that the both of your presentations addressed the impact of homelessness on our youth, the mental impact, the emotional impact, the instability that it has on their health, as well as our elder community, especially our baby boomers, who are dealing with numbers of outrageous impacts of dementia and Alzheimer's that can't afford senior care or are not even seniors yet. Developing these conditions where that health home care is at $6,000 a month in my district of West St. Paul and St. Paul. So I really want to give you that thanks, and I look forward to speaking with both of you in this legislative session to address these concerns on home equity for all. Gracias.
Thank you, and thanks to the members of the committee. Just a couple housekeeping items. We do have the rules for our committee in your packet. We did make some edits based on feedback from folks, so take a look at that. And tomorrow we'll continue to kind of talk about the whole continuum of housing and have more folks here. And so with that, we are adjourned.